This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Massachusetts Department of Correction has been violating the constitutional rights of inmates with mental illness. That is the finding of a report from U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling's office. The report's a result of a two-year investigation into mental health care for prisoners at several Massachusetts correctional facilities. And U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mr. Lelling, this document, it's difficult to read. It outlines instances of harsh treatment of those who are mentally ill while they're behind bars. Your report refers to, quote, a high concentration of harm in the areas that are supposed to be the most safe and therapeutic, end quote. Were you surprised by what you found in this investigation?
We were a little bit surprised. And the reason why I phrased it that way is that this sort of problem is persistent in corrections facilities across the United States, because what happens is you have a lack of money in state budgets and you have a lack of training for prison personnel. And often what that leads to is a breakdown in treatment for people who are in the midst of a mental health crisis. And so in my career at the department, I have seen that before. And that's the kind of thing that we saw here.
So in the report, there's an emphasis on people who are in mental health crisis. I'm married to a mental health practitioner. I know times of crisis call for, you know, responsive treatment, responsive care. Can you explain how the Department of Correction has failed inmates in those moments and with that kind of treatment?
Well, it's a systemic breakdown, and you put your finger right on it before, which is that one of the most interesting observations we made is that the people on mental health watch in the DOC system are supposed to be in the safest place, but because of systemic issues, they're actually in the unsafest place. The problem is that when people in general population in the jails are in a mental health crisis, they're placed under mental health watch, which means they're moved to a separate cell. And what is supposed to happen there is they're supposed to have, one, close supervision, and then, two, access to treatment to try to stabilize them and allay any suicidal feelings that they're having and get them back into general population. But that's not what happens. The mental health watch area, those cells that they use, essentially amount to what we used to call solitary confinement and now call restrictive housing, which if you leave someone there long enough can be extremely psychologically stressful. In addition to that, the supervision of those people, meaning corrections officers watching them either intermittently or full-time, was lacking, and the officers were leaving gaps in supervision that allowed people on mental health watch to hurt themselves because they weren't being observed. There was also a lack of care from mental health professionals. Maybe someone on mental health watch would see a therapist for 5 minutes on a given day and probably talk to them through, you know, an opening in the cell door, which is not really conducive to actual treatment.
And you have to report also... I just want to stop you there to add to that a little bit, because your report also suggested that people being under mental health watch still had access to objects that might allow for self-harm or even attempted suicide.
Yes, that's right. And so the procedures that most of the DOC facilities we saw were using were not sufficient to catch objects like razors or paper clips or other things that could be used for self-harm being smuggled into these mental health watch cells. And so we saw many, many instances in which inmates who already have psychological issues are placed in this more stressful environment where they're socially isolated and left to their own devices and their own thoughts and their own voices in their heads, and they have items they can use to harm themselves. And so that created the problems that you see itemized in the report.
And in that itemization, we are talking about a lot of instances. At one point, it says the DOC reported that prisoners engaged in self-harm 688 times while on mental health watch. And 4 of 8 who died of suicide were on mental health watch when they died. Can you give our listeners a sense of the magnitude of harm here?
Well, it is a high magnitude of harm in that the Department of Correction system clearly has problems that must be fixed, which is why we did the investigation and is why we issued the report. But again, unfortunately, you would find correctional systems across the United States that have similar problems. And so what we saw here, the problems we saw here, you can generally trace to a lack of training and a lack of funding. The lack of training is the lack of training of corrections officers who are supposed to deal with people who are having mental health issues, and they're not getting that training. The lack of funding stems maybe not primarily, but in large part, from the state of Massachusetts changing the definition of those who are entitled to mental health treatment in correctional settings in 2019, which increased the pool of people who need help, but the number of therapists and mental health professionals operating in the jails did not see a commensurate increase in resources. So you have too few therapists and too many inmates who need help. You put all this together and you have the rate of self-harm that we saw in the department's correctional system.
So with what you just laid out, especially comparing it with other states, I understand that you were then also saying that you didn't in your investigation find that these were willful or intentional situations. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, that's right. The DOC was extremely cooperative with our investigation. Cooperation is on a spectrum. You have investigations where correctional facilities are grudgingly cooperative or not cooperative, and then you have ones where they're genuinely cooperative, point you to what you need to see, help you see the relevant files, and that was what we had here. So they did a very good job with that. I'm hoping that will continue as we try to work out how to remedy these problems. So on an officer-by-officer basis, I think there was occasionally intentional misconduct, but that is not the overall story. It's really just people trying to do a good job in a system that has not given them great training and which is underfunded.
So you just talked about that level of cooperation. Here's Governor Baker. He did comment on the report today during a press conference he was holding. Here he is.
We are going to implement every recommendation that's in there. A lot of that stuff that he recommends and his folks recommended came out of dialogue and conversation that's taken place with DOC over the course of the investigation. And while we have focused real hard on a bunch of different things associated with DOC over the course of the past few years around criminal justice reform, managing COVID, and dealing with Bridgewater State Hospital, this is a fail that needs to get fixed.
So, you know, you pointed out that they cooperated. There's the governor owning it, saying this is a fail. But I do want to ask, did you encounter any areas doing this two-year investigation where the Mass Department of Correction dragged its feet, where you had trouble getting information? Are there pain points there we should be aware of?
No. We visited nearly every DOC facility over the course of the two-year investigation and looked at thousands of pages of incident reports, policies, training manuals. They gave us access to prisoners. We interviewed prisoners. We interviewed correction staff. The administration of Massachusetts Department of Corrections was extremely cooperative. I think in the report, you will see isolated instances where corrections officers committed intentional misconduct, or at least it seems that way to us. Sometimes they were appropriately reprimanded, sometimes not. That's something that DOC needs to work on. But overall, they were extremely cooperative. And so that's why I'm optimistic about making real strides toward remedying the situation. This isn't something you fix overnight, but I think you will see material progress in the relatively short term.
And can you explain for our listeners, you've said a few intentional instances, largely unintentional, but you drew the conclusion that there are violations of prisoners' constitutional rights going on here. Can you explain that?
The violation of constitutional rights, let me back up a step. If someone's incarcerated for a crime, the state is undertaking the responsibility for that person's care and well-being while they're in jail. You have to give them minimal, lodging, food, mental health care. Mental health care is included in that. They're entitled to that. And so what you have here is a failure to provide sufficient care. And you have a few different strands that came together to create a constitutional problem. So in short, because we've been discussing, the way these DOC facilities were treating patients in mental health crisis was actually greatly increasing the chance that they would harm themselves, that they would come to harm. And in that manner, these facilities were violating the constitutional rights of those who were in desperate need of mental health treatment. We're talking about inmates who were suicidal and then placed into conditions that exacerbated their suicidal tendencies. That's no one person's fault. It's a systemic breakdown. But that systemic breakdown led to unconstitutional conditions. And so that's what we're trying to fix.
Okay, and who's going to oversee the implementation of your recommendations? And what happens if things don't change or some of those recommendations aren't implemented?
Well, there are a few ways to get at this. That remains to be seen. So my staff here and some staff from Washington at the Justice Department are now in negotiations with the Department of Corrections to figure out how to implement what we think is needed to alleviate these problems. This usually results in a written agreement that is available to the public. That written agreement can be a private settlement agreement, essentially a contract between the Justice Department and the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. It can be a consent decree, so that is enforceable by a court. It can involve the appointment of an outside monitor who is given access to every corner of the DOC system and is tasked with making sure DOC meets whatever metrics we set in the written agreement. We don't always do that, but we do often do that, especially when you have a sprawling correctional system like this one. And so those are some tools in the toolbox. It's way premature to know what is going to be necessary or desired here in resolving this case. The fact that the state has been cooperative with us will make it easier to resolve it, but the devil's in the details about how to make sure these fixes get done.
Okay, and before we let you go here, I want to shift gears and ask you one other question. We have had a presidential election. The major media outlets have called that election for Joe Biden. President Trump has maintained the election was stolen from him, and he's the rightful winner. Attorney General William Barr issued a memo authorizing federal prosecutors to investigate allegations of voter fraud if they're credible. I want to ask you, do you recognize Joe Biden as the president-elect? And what happens in your office on January 20th? When the new president is inaugurated?
Well, I'm going to skip the first part, and I'm going to go to the second part, which won't surprise you. One of the great things about my jurisdiction extending only to the four corners of the state of Massachusetts is that I can confine my comments to the four corners of the state of Massachusetts. As to the second point, what usually happens with United States attorneys is after the new administration comes in, at some point they will ask any remaining U.S. attorneys to leave. Somebody can check me on this, but I think when the Trump administration came in, whatever Obama U.S. attorneys were remaining were asked to leave in March or April of 2017. My guess, and it really is just a guess, is that about the same thing is going to happen here. So all the U.S. attorneys are now lame duck. We're all thinking about what comes next. You know, most of us will begin to slowly go out the door and look for jobs in the private sector or elsewhere. And those that remain, I think, in the early spring will probably be asked to set a date for departure so that the new slate of political appointees under the new president can come in.
Well, U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling, I know these are busy times. Thanks for taking some time for us today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's turn our attention to Worcester. So Worcester has had a vibrant and growing economy. Bloomberg recently rated them 8th out of 100 large U.S. cities in terms of their potential for growth. At the same time, they're being hit hard by this latest wave of the coronavirus. The DCU Center, in fact, is again being converted to a field hospital to help deal with surging cases. All of that makes Worcester a kind of potential case study for all of us in terms of how it navigates the virus and its economic recovery on the other side. Joining us now is Worcester City Manager Edward Augustus Jr. Edward, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just start by asking, Thanksgiving's coming up. How are you, your family? How you doing?
I think everybody's pretty stressed out, trying to figure out how to enjoy a holiday season with lots of restrictions and lots of changes. So I think my family, like every family in the country, is stressed but trying to make the best of a tough situation.
Yeah. On WBUR this morning, we heard from Dr. John Broach, who's emergency medicine specialist at UMass Memorial. He's going to serve as the medical director of this field hospital. He said that Worcester's already beginning to feel the effects of this second wave in terms of, you know, hospitalizations capacity. You said last Thursday, after the city had its 300th COVID death, quote, "We are not at a good place in the city of Worcester," end quote. I am sorry about those deaths. And I want to ask you today, where is the city in the surge?
Unfortunately, we're continuing to see a significant increase in the number of cases and in the hospitalizations. we're on track. We do a weekly press conference every Thursday, and we're probably on track for tomorrow's press conference to announce about 600 additional cases, which is just a significant increase over the last week and significantly above the weeks prior. So I think that we're going to see a surge that is more significant than what we saw in the springtime, at least in terms of cases. We're hopeful that that doesn't turn into a significant increase in terms of mortality. There are more therapeutics. I think our healthcare community has figured out better strategies for treating patients. But it's still a very dangerous, worrisome time, and the DCU is just the evidence of what we're anticipating to be a number of weeks of increasing numbers, both in cases and hospitalization.
Does it feel out of control to you right now?
I don't know if it's out of control, but it certainly is clear that this community spread at a significant rate. We've got a number of cases that we cannot tie back to a particular, you know, family gathering or restaurant or event. And so that just suggests that it's very much present in the community and people are not clear on where they're picking it up, where it's being transmitted from person to person, which makes it all the more scary and all the more essential that, you know, we get better compliance with the mask requirements, with the social distancing, you know, limiting times when you are coming in contact with folks, you know, whether it be inside dining or retail. And we know we're in the time of season with the weather being colder, people are moving inside. We know we're in the holiday season, so people are shopping and trying to reconnect with families. And so the message is that much harder given the season and given, quite honestly, I think some fatigue that people have with, you know, following those measures.
So I'm really hearing you, especially with the amount of unknown about, you know, where it's coming from, how people are getting it other than speculation. It sounds like this really is about how you get people to return to or dial up to a level of compliance that is both voluntary and that you're not getting right now. So how do you do that?
You know, we've really tried to figure out every which way. A couple of weeks ago, as you mentioned in your introduction, we did a visual display of what the toll of the virus has taken just on the Worcester population. We put 300 roses kind of in the shape of a heart, which is part of our seal of the city. We're the heart of the Commonwealth, right in the middle of the state. And we wanted to give a visual representation of how many lives have been lost, how many people started 2020 with us and are not here now because of the virus. And, you know, we've had young people. We had a 21-year-old young man, no pre-existing conditions, who back in April got the virus, ended up being on a vent, and was very close to losing his life, to try to put a face and a story behind the idea that young people, who often find themselves, you know, think of themselves as invincible, or if I get it, it won't be a big deal, to try to remind people, no, that's not always the case. It can be a big deal. It can be a life-threatening situation. It's not just elderly or people with, you know, pre-existing conditions. Anybody can get this, and anybody can get it in a severe way. And we're not quite clear why that is, why some people seem to get, you know, that much sicker without those pre-existing conditions, but it's possible, and so everybody should be on their guard.
I got to tell you, the mental image of 300 roses in the shape of a heart is just a gut punch. Well, how is the community of Worcester doing? What's the collective psyche or well-being of Worcester right now?
I think overall good. The people in Worcester really are resilient. You know, Worcester has, like a lot of communities, had its ups and downs economically. We've had firefighter losses, you know, in recent years that have really, you know, challenged the community and shooken it to its core, whether it be 20 years ago with the Worcester Six or even just a year ago with Lieutenant Menard. And, you know, Worcester has proven itself to be resilient and tough and resourceful. And I think we're seeing that. But, you know, when you drag it out over now these many months and with the prospect of going through the holiday season and probably into 21, you know, I know there's a fatigue, there's a frustration, there's the collective kind of anxiety and you know, trauma, really, that families are experiencing, not only trying to keep everybody safe with from the virus, but maybe having kids at home, they're trying to keep up with the online learning, maybe with a job that, you know, somebody in the family has lost or had their hours cut back on, rents that are back due. I mean, there's a lot of pressures on people and families. And, you know, we need to continue to just do everything we can to support them. And, you know, we've had a Worcester Together Fund, which raised almost $11 million, that really helped fill some of the gaps that the federal, state, and local funding couldn't fill with, for meals, for testing of the homeless, for, you know, help with back due rent, helping some of our small businesses, our arts and cultural organizations, not-for-profits, many of which, you know, are teetering because they haven't been able to have their fundraisers and their other events that kind of keep them functioning. So I think we're all in a challenging time and, you know, concerned about the future.
You know, I don't want to sound callous by turning to the future, and I don't want to be in denial about the moment we're in, but I do want to take a minute to look at what the future could be for Worcester and what that's going to take. You know, the airport's been a priority for the city, but my understanding is all major airlines have stopped flying in and out. The Woo Sox have been an exciting and promising thing for Worcester. You know, tickets to sit atop the Worcester Wall went on sale today. They're supposed to start playing in the spring, but that contract's not done. Do you have the building blocks you need in place to move forward economically once we have a vaccine in hand and are starting to find ourselves on the other side of this pandemic?
I really think we do. You know, there's certainly setbacks that Worcester's experiencing like any other place is experiencing. And the travel and tourism industry is particularly hard hit. And we know airlines had been reduced by 90-95%. And so as soon as the PPE, you know, requirements elapsed, many of them canceled services to cities around the country. And Worcester certainly was impacted by that. We're seeing hotels particularly hard hit. We are seeing, you know, some of the retailers hard hit. We still are seeing very strong activities in life sciences. You know, Worcester's home to the medical school. We have a very big and growing biotechnology park. And we have a very robust biomanufacturing sector, Wuxi Biologics, which is a Chinese-owned biomanufacturing company, has broke ground. They're building their facility. Two other sites on that biomanufacturing park are under construction. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing strong signs there. Also, the housing sector is particularly strong here in Worcester. We have one of the most robust housing markets in the state and in the country, quite honestly. So we're seeing weakness in some areas of the economy, strength in other areas. And, you know, but I think the fundamentals of Worcester are strong. We've got a great workforce. Yeah.
And that is encouraging, and I believe you. And yet I also want to ask you, some things must be hanging in the balance. If it's not the airport, if it's not the Woo Sox, although that one, I have to admit, as an observer, looks like it's hanging in the balance. Are there some critical things hanging in the balance that you think need particular attention or are going to have to kind of break right for you?
Well, you know, there's a number of projects that have had to be put on hold. We've had hotel development. Some of the development around the ballpark has had to be put on a slower schedule than originally was planned. Several of them were hotels, office buildings. Those areas are tough to finance right now because mm-hmm. people don't know what the future of, you know, office space is going to be with people working from home. We've had Unum, which is a large insurance company that's had a long-time presence in downtown. They went to remote work option at the start of the pandemic, and they've since announced they're going to stay that way. So they're not going to be returning to their offices. And so that's a couple of hundred people who used to work in downtown, go to lunch, support some of the local businesses in the downtown. And so there are going to be, I assume, more impacts like that. I think the virtual workplace has worked for a lot of employers and employees, and I do think we're going to have to be reimagining what the typical office environment looks like post-pandemic, which is going to be different than what it was before. So I think that's something we're all going to have to figure out and adapt to.
And that is Worcester City Manager Edward Augustus Jr. I appreciate you joining us. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Thanksgiving's going to have to look different this year.
Today, we're urging everybody to make a difficult choice this Thanksgiving. If we treat this year just like we treat every other Thanksgiving, it's quite likely that it will trigger a significant spread.
Yeah, earlier today, Governor Baker asked people to gather just with immediate households, which means a lot of people are going to cancel plans. People are planning to stay home. I know I called off the last vestige of a gathering with my longtime bubble, you know what, an hour and a half ago. I want to talk about that. We all do. What are you doing for Thanksgiving this year? Are you changing your plans? Are they still in flux? How are you feeling about it? You know, do you know what's going to be different? Do you know what you're going to preserve? Do you have plans for how you're going to find joy if it's going to be very different? And also, are you still trying to figure out what to do? Because we can also talk about what's safe, how to be together safely if you have to be. Maybe gathering is inevitable for you, like a college student coming home. Taking calls on all of it. 800-423-8255. Excuse me. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston, and we have two great guests for this conversation. We have Dr. Cassandra Pierre, an infectious disease physician and assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Pierre is also the medical director of public health programs and the associate hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center. We also have Beth Titel, a good friend of the show, a Boston Globe reporter who has been writing on this. Welcome back to both of you.
Wonderful to be here.
So I think I should ask of each of you first, what are your plans for Thanksgiving? Dr. Pierre, do you mind sharing?
Absolutely. I'm a bit saddened. I had, in the summer when things looked better, thought about, you know, a multi-pronged 10-point plan to get people safely, a group of 10 less into our household to have Thanksgiving. But about a few weeks ago, I realized that was not going to happen. So just having Thanksgiving with our immediate family, and we will have a walk in the park 6 feet apart with the grandparents.
Beth, how about you?
We're also just going to have our immediate family. My in-laws live close, but we'll probably just maybe do a drive-by to say hi to them. And I was realizing I've been doing, as you were saying, so much reporting on it that I hadn't thought about my own feelings because I was talking to other people about theirs. And when I was just talking to my mother earlier today, when we realized that we decided we'd separately make this apple dessert, that we're the only two people who like it in the whole group of 12 that usually gather. So we decided we'd each in our own places make a single serving of the apple dessert and do it that way.
It's kind of ironic that you're the only two people who like it, and now there's going to be twice as much of it, basically.
Exactly.
So, Dr. Pierre, I talked about what Governor Baker said today. We know Marty Walsh has also been, you know, Mayor of Boston has been very clear. He would like people to stay within their individual households. Can you tell us what the CDC guidance is and if there's any other official guidance around Thanksgiving gathering this year?
Yeah, well, I will say that the guidance in general has been for any in-person gathering indoors has been to keep it at 10 people or less. With the rising rates of COVID-19 across the country, many leaders, including Anthony Fauci, have tried to lead by example by saying that they are not going to be having their own Thanksgiving dinner, including with their adult children, and looking for different ways, as you've mentioned, to find joy. The line from public health officials and infectious disease doctors and the medical establishment alike has been to, whenever possible, enjoy Thanksgiving within your own bubble and preserve as many future Thanksgivings down the line to be healthy as they can be.
Let's go straight to the phones here, 800-423-8255. Pull up a chair to our table and join this conversation. We've got Laura on the line from Mattapan. Laura, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just calling because I'm having a non-traditional in-house potluck with my partner and our two roommates. None of us has ever done a turkey, so we're afraid to do it. So we're each just going to make a dish that we like and that we know everyone else likes and have a meal after we go to Plymouth to be with the Indigenous people for their 50th anniversary.
Thanks for the call, Laura. As the turkey cooker in my house, I think a healthy fear of cooking a turkey is actually probably appropriate. So, Beth, you've done some writing on this. Laura's talking about, you know, we're going to do things differently. We're going to join with others in the experience they're having on Thanksgiving. What are you hearing about people's relationships between tradition and this Thanksgiving?
Oh, well, first of all, I think that the lock that the turkey has had on Thanksgiving is going to be broken. I think a lot of people are going to be freed from making the turkey, like Laura is, and like you're saying, you're nervous about it. People might think, well, there's no one observing me. I'm not doing it this year. And I wonder next year if people are like, not going to do it all. I'm thinking that this year is going to be, the Thanksgiving story is going to just be the sides. You know, everybody just likes the sides the best anyway. one thing I was struck by was Thanksgiving has always been a holiday that's about a number. People say, how many people are you having? And the answer was always, we're having 15, and that was who was coming. And you would tell my grandmother, my brother from California, this person. This year, it's also about a number, but the number tells a different story. It's a sad one. It's who's not coming. Well, we're only going to be four because my Aunt Donna's not going to pick up my grandmother on the Cape. This isn't going to happen. I guess it will make us really appreciate next year's Thanksgiving, since Thanksgiving had been a holiday that there were sort of two parallel stories. There was, oh, we love being with family. And then there was like Thanksgiving. Like people were so afraid of Thanksgiving. All the stories are about the stress of dealing with your toxic family. But now people are missing that. Like I myself, I'm always stressed when I have to cook a turkey. But now I'm kind of missing that stress. The anticipatory non-stress is saddening me.
It's like condition dependent. So Dr. Pierre, we have this group of people who are for sure going to travel on Thanksgiving, which is some college students who are returning home. Governor Baker issued some new guidance as far as college students who are planning to return home. I want to play that for you. Here's his new guidance. This is for both on and off campus students.
Any students leaving campus to go home for the holidays should first receive a negative COVID-19 test administered by the college within 72 hours of their planned departure. And if possible, residential colleges should also offer COVID-19 tests to students who live off campus who plan to return home.
Now, we know many universities, not all, but many have the capacity to meet that threshold. So let's assume a student gets the test. Let's review again, a negative test 72 hours before their planned departure. What does that mean about their likelihood of having the infection 72 hours later?
Yeah, that's a great question. It may be a false sense of assurance. It is certainly good to go ahead and get the test before leaving to know about your risk. But within 72 hours leaves a lot of time. People might decide to go to a party right before they leave. And even if they are truly negative when they leave, the act of traveling itself implies some risk and exposure to infection on the way there, especially with close, public and non-public modes of transportation. We actually have seen a case here where a daughter returning from college was negative prior to leaving, linked up with a person who was not from her social group before going and after her test, and did not quarantine when she came home, and unfortunately exposed and infected her mother. So I do think that even though the testing is important, I would recommend that if possible, those students also get tests after returning home and maybe even quarantine for a few days, which seems so unnatural, but does increase the safety of their return.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. They are coming in, 800-423-8255. Let's talk to Tom from Norwood. Tom, go ahead.
This is going to be the best Thanksgiving ever. And the reason is because it's going to be different. You know, we're going to remember this for years to come. 20 years from now, we're going to remember this Thanksgiving because of how screwed up it was. And on top of that, not everybody is going enjoys Thanksgiving. You know, seeing their relatives that they might love and hate, hearing the same stories over and over again, eating the same food over and over again. You know, this is going to be different and more memorable, I think. And next
so Tom,
Thanksgiving,
my chuckle.
Year from, yeah,
no,
next,
go, go.
Next year, it'll be the typical Thanksgiving, but this is going to be better because it'll be different.
So my chuckle was just, honestly, gratitude for your optimism. It's a rough conversation, rough day. Beth, let me give you a chance to react to Tom there.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good point. A lot of people before this year, I was always writing stories about people dreading Thanksgiving with their families, and in fact had come up with an idea where instead of having to travel to see a family that might cause you some anxiety, you could be matched with a local family. So everybody would stay put and just have like, okay, I'm going to spend the time with this family and they're going to make me feel bad in these certain ways, but at least I don't need to travel for it. But, you know, I think that there is some comfort that I agree completely with the caller that for a lot of people it is a hard time, but I think that for a lot of people they do, it is important because that tradition does kind of ground them and it sort of sets their calendar. I was looking at this quote from Mayor Walsh, and he said, we don't want to do this, but as the holidays go on, people are going to call 911, meaning that if you have more than 10 people, you could have your neighbors calling to rat you out. So I was thinking that suppose you did want to have more than 10 people, you'd have to have your relatives dressed as service people so they could come in under the guise of actually doing some work on your house and then stay for Thanksgiving, dressed in regular clothes, and then change. But it is going to be an unusual one. You're certainly right about that.
So I'm just gonna clarify, Beth, that you are not actually recommending that people disguise themselves and go into other people's homes. Just
no,
gonna be clear about that.
Okay, good point. I'm not actually suggesting that, but it has gotten. I got a PR pitch from a major grocer that's offering Thanksgiving insurance. If you buy a turkey, I guess people are not buying turkeys. They're saying if you buy a turkey from us, they've teamed up with Progressive Insurance, and you mess up, like you don't have, the bird fails. They're going to give you, you can put in a claim for $35, but it's limited to the first 1,000 people who put in a claim. So you might want to do it soon.
Yeah. And listen, Beth, we actually have the quote from Mayor Walsh. I think it's worth hearing. So we're going to play it here. Yeah. I think this was today.
As the holidays go on, people are going to call 911, police are going to show up if they get called to a scene, and they're going to be notifying inspectional service that are going to come out and be finding landlords and tenants. Quite honestly, if this gets to the point where we have to do that, I mean, we don't want to do that. I mean, that's the last thing I want to do on Thanksgiving. But, and I know people aren't agreeing with what I'm saying right now, but the numbers aren't lying. The coronavirus numbers are going up. This is real.
And I do want to correct myself there. Sorry, that was yesterday, not today. Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Gabby on the line from Medford. Gabby, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have plans as of now to get together with my family, but that involves 3 different households. And I can keep on rationalizing reasons why it should be fine, because we're all going to get tested, including the 2 little kids, and 2 of the households have seen each other recently anyway. But now that this new guideline has come out, I'm really thinking I should question that, and I know that everyone else in my family will be quite disappointed if I do question that, but I'm just looking for some advice on that. And we are less than 10 people in total.
Thanks for that, Gabby. Dr. Pierre, this one feels kind of made for you. What would your advice to Gabby be?
Yeah, so I would say that you would honestly need to assess your own risk tolerance. Obviously, the only way to completely remain safe is to remain completely isolated. And also, if there's anyone in that group that's elderly, immunosuppressed, or has a serious underlying medical condition, then you need to weigh the risks of having the holiday celebration against that benefit. If that doesn't apply to you, then you need to ensure that everyone is committed equally to infection prevention recommendations. And I say this because the other part of my job in public health is about harm reduction. So we know that people will do things that are not necessarily what the guidance is, but I want to make sure that if they do, they have the things at their disposal that will allow them to reduce risk of exposure and infection. So quarantining as much as possible, staying home if you can and working from home for as long as you can, ideally 14 days, but obviously we're less than that out now. So as much time as you can, not going out with people outside of your bubble, and also trying to be aware of the other things that cause you risk without you being aware of it. For example, being in a poorly ventilated space for long periods of time. So I'm thinking about, unfortunately, places like the gym and indoor restaurants, limiting your exposure to those as well. The testing was mentioned. I think that's great. But as we mentioned one test might not be sufficient and may lead you to have a false sense of security. I would actually recommend kind of stacking testing if you have the option to do so, getting tested maybe now and then again a day or two before for better potentially reliability and more assurance that you may be actually negative. You've already limited the guest list, so kudos on that. That's great. Try to ventilate if possible. Open up the windows. Maybe put in an air purifier. If it's unseasonably warm, which I don't think is on the forecast, but if it is, think about having as much as the celebration, especially the eating component, outside if you can.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. We've got more calls, 800-423-8255. Michael's calling from Wayland. Michael, go ahead.
Thanks. So my saintly wife has arranged for us to deliver meals to people during Thanksgiving, people who wouldn't have those delivered otherwise. And so I guess my Thanksgiving number won't be as much about who's not at the table, but, you know, who we can kind of, how many people we can get meals to. Well, you know, thank goodness for my wife.
Oh, that sounds great. Michael, before you go, let me ask you, do you have a sense of how many meals you'd like to get to people? Are you talking two or three, or what's your goal?
Last year we got a whole bunch made, but the making of the meals was in a group context, and so that is out. So the delivery wasn't, we only managed to get to three or four families, but we managed to assemble quite a few. I don't know how the process works this year, but it's just, I don't know, it's a way to focus not so much on what you don't have, but on, you know, all that we do. And I'm just, I don't know, seems like the spirit of the holiday.
It does, Michael. Thanks for that. And Dr. Pierre, I'm going to come back to you for just a second and then go to Beth. Michael's making me think if there are others who are inspired by him or doing something similar. Let's talk about safety and food delivery. So what needs to happen there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to thank Michael and Tom for their optimism. I feel like they're going to live longer, different types of optimism. But I think there are definitely some ground rules for this in terms of the process. Clearly, as Michael acknowledges, the group setting for meal preparation is out of the question at this point, unless it's with the people that are already within your household. So putting someone on Zoom or putting on some good music while you're preparing the food would be the best way to go about it. When you're boxing, probably leaving those things on the doorstep, you can certainly hand it over to the people if they're, you know, no, there is no harm in handing it over to people. Certainly don't come in if they, you know, ask you if they're nice and tried to be or enact the pre-COVID model of hospitality by trying to invite you in for a drink. But, you know, leaving on the doorstep or handing it over is certainly safe. Obviously, bringing hand sanitizer with you will be great. I also just want to mention something quickly about food allocation within a household, especially if you are combining households for a dinner. I would recommend that the server be limited to one individual to limit congregation around the food. That's also a touch point where we see a lot of exposure and infection.
And Beth, you know, to this idea of refocusing your Thanksgiving to what you can be grateful for, service to others, ways to show up for other people, even when we do it from afar. Again, you talk to a lot of people as you're writing your pieces and getting a sense of where people's heads and hearts are. So I want to give you a chance to weigh in on that and respond to that.
Oh, you know, first of all, I just love the idea of doing service to others. It's just wonderful. I think what people find really important about the holiday is connecting with family members in person that they, you know, you don't always get to see them. But I was thinking about a Zoom, not a traditional Zoom Thanksgiving where you have two groups doing a big Zoom, which can sometimes be hard to, you know, it can be hard. Like if you have 12 people on a Zoom, you're not having a one-on-one conversation. I was thinking about having the Zoom link open for a long time and people just kind of wander by and talk to whoever they want, whoever is, you know, happens to be on the Zoom link on the other side. You could even have three or four families doing that. I was talking about that with someone, and they said, just make sure that if you're gossiping, you're not caught on some kind of hot mic or something. But I thought that was sort of a nice way. Or maybe also just having a phone call. Like everybody takes, you know, it's so nice to take a walk with your family, but maybe even go for a walk by yourself and call someone that you, maybe a relative who you usually would have Thanksgiving with, but you wouldn't call. So you can really have a nice one-on-one conversation. That might be a way to really bring some depth and some warmth to the holiday.
I'd love to get one more call in. So we've got Peter from Plymouth. Peter, you are up.
Okay, yes. It's a really odd parallel. We moved to Plymouth just this year, and in Plymouth, it's, you know, it's the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims arriving. And in 1620, everybody was sick. And so we're pushing off our big Plymouth Thanksgiving until next year, like the Pilgrims did in 1621. So the real Thanksgiving was next year. So for us, it seems almost natural living in Plymouth to push it off one year.
Peter, I appreciate that point. And I also want to let listeners know we have started to do some stuff on Radio Boston around the 400th anniversary. We talked to a Wampanoag historian, actually, about that time and the point Peter just made. We're going to do more of that. Dr. Peter, not the first time that we, in our American history and human history, that we have had to deal with pandemics and the way they interfere with how we interact with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that there are vestiges still from the 1918-1919 flu pandemic. Think ways, big and small, that it's changed our society. People have talked about the fact that we don't have spittoons in restaurants anymore, which I am appreciative for, I guess. And I think, as you know, as has already been discussed and Beth has mentioned, I think this will change our sense of whether we want to adhere to tradition or not. I do think that I actually disagree with Tom, the previous caller, about whether next season's Thanksgiving will be memorable, because I think it will happen with a vengeance, especially if we feel like we are, you know, able to do so. The vaccines may not be the magic bullet, but I think that we certainly have an opportunity in this time of stress and crisis to be innovative, and also take with us what we think is meaningful about this holiday. So having a smaller gathering is medically and public health-wise necessary, and may also lead to a more intimate gathering and sharing.
And to part of Peter's point with being in Plymouth, there are many for whom Thanksgiving has meaning, but it's negative meaning. You know, if the Indigenous community celebrates a national day of mourning on Thanksgiving. So I want to be aware of all the different ways that people come to and encounter this particular holiday. With that, Beth, we have limited time left. I do want to take a minute to pivot again to gratitude. There are moments in life where we have an opportunity to mark what we appreciate. How are you thinking about that?
You know, I love that. Earlier in the pandemic, I talked to it was actually fairly early, but I guess enough time had gone on. People were talking about having a number of people existential crises. This pause allowed them to look at how they had been living and to see whether it was how they wanted to continue living. And I think that a day like Thanksgiving really gives us an extra opportunity to do that, to say, am I happy with how, am I making other people feel good? Am I doing enough for other people? Not even, I mean, in big ways too, but even in small ways, like am I being a good enough friend or good enough daughter or mother, whatever your, you know, role is. So I'm hoping that this Thanksgiving is really a time to give thanks for what we have and to also reflect on maybe how we can help make the world just a little bit nicer.
And that is a great note to stop. That is Beth Tytel of the Boston Globe and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, an infectious disease physician and assistant professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Engineering today is by Jimmy Kiesling. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for your calls. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.